Do you ever struggle with remembering details from your travels? Then I've got something special for you. How would you like a better way to keep track of all the things you see and experience in Scotland? A way to keep those special memories and all the details fresh for years to come? My new Scotland Travel Journal might just be what you need. It includes daily journaling prompts to help you start writing about your day, lots of space for doodling and notes, prompts to reflect on your trip overall, and suggestions for things to do that help you make more meaningful connections with Scotland. There's also inspiration for your travel bucket list, a map to draw your route, space to keep track of your travel details, and some Gaelic and Scottish phrases to try while you're here. All you have to do is print out the journal, fold the pages in half, and start writing. The Scotland Travel Journal is the perfect companion for your upcoming trip to Scotland. Find it in the Watch Me See online shop or visit the link in the show notes. And now, let's get on with the show. Hello there, and welcome to Wild for Scotland, a podcast full of immersive travel stories from Scotland. I'm your host and storyteller, Cathy Kamleitner. Wild for Scotland helps you connect with Scotland, its people, wildlife, landscapes and histories. In every episode, I either whisk you away on a beautiful adventure or introduce you to inspiring locals and their stories. In between, I share my top tips for your own Scotland trip and how to follow in my footsteps. So lean back and enjoy. Let's travel to Scotland. It's our birthday. Well, it was 2 days ago. Back in 2021, on the 2nd of March, we published our very first episode of Wild for Scotland. And it's quite incredible how much the podcast has developed and grown over the past 3 years. We've produced over 60 episodes with stories, conversations and interviews. And to celebrate this, I wanted to do a little bit of a recap and look back at some of the things you may not know about the show and some of my favourite experiences along the way. Our first season was all about the Scottish Isles, and to be honest, it was all pretty much DIY. I edited everything myself and did all the soundscapes on my own as well, and I just remember spending so many hours getting that first episode ready and subsequently getting all the other 9 episodes ready. It was pretty intense and a very, very steep learning curve. About halfway through, my microphone broke, and I think I recorded on a microphone that I would attach to my camera. It wasn't even a podcasting microphone. Anyway, it broke and I had to get an entirely new setup and figure out how to actually use a proper microphone on my desk, which, by the way, has broken since then as well. So I'm now recording on another microphone again. So yeah, technological issues have never left my side since the start of this podcast. Back then, all the stories we told, or I told, were from memory, because if you remember, 2021, we were still in the throes of COVID, and especially in Glasgow, we were under quite strict lockdown regulations even at that point. So I wasn't able to travel and make any new experience for the podcast, but it was quite nice to revisit some of the things I had experienced the years before that and write stories about them. The second season, I think, was a big jump from there. On the one hand, I could finally travel for the podcast and create new experiences and stories. But also Fran came on board to edit the podcast and do all the sound design, taking a very big chunk of something I wasn't very good at and didn't enjoy very much, to be quite honest, taking that chunk off my desk. And so I could focus on telling stories and she could figure out and making them sound good. At that point, I didn't have a recorder to take with me on the road yet, though, so there was no on-location recordings. Everything was just, again, written about my trips from memories, just more previous memories. The second season contained 10 stories, and they were all about road trips, and each of them corresponded with one of my ready-made itineraries for Scotland, which you can still buy on my website. And if you listen to that season, whatever episode you like the best, have a look at that itinerary and maybe that's the perfect trip to Scotland for you. In our third season, the year after, we introduced interviews, which was very exciting for me. I was very nervous about interviewing people, but very quickly realised that it's something I really enjoy doing, especially featuring other voices and other stories on the show. I finally decided to travel with a recorder, and so the stories from season 3 and also season 4 all contain on-location recordings, which again was very, very new for me. The theme was inspired by Scotland's Year of Stories, and so the same theme continued into season 4. I knew I wanted to record more interviews, speak with more people, and feature other voices on the show as well. And I think a personal highlight for me that season was the episode Creature of the Sea, which was all based on my experiences at the snorkeling artist residency at the Argyle Hope Spot on the west coast of Scotland. And I think what we did with that episode, the poetry, Jen's wonderful music, and also Fran's sound design, the three really came together to create these immersive underwater experiences or journeys for our listeners. And I feel really proud to this day of the work that we've achieved with that episode. And we've won an award for it, you know, we've had it featured in exhibitions, and it's still kind of making the rounds as we speak. I've submitted it to other things. So yeah, that work really is some of my best, I think, and one of the things I'm most proud of when I look back at the last 3 years of the podcast. In our third year of the podcast, which was last year, we got to work on some really cool sponsor projects as well, like episodes about rewilding and solo travel. So last year was the first year we didn't produce two seasons, but in exchange for that, we got to do a lot of really cool, more in-depth projects with partners. And then our fifth season had the theme of Scottish waters. And I think to me, it connected a lot of the elements of the podcast from before, the storytelling, the interviews, the immersive soundscapes, and of course also the recordings from my actual trips and from my adventures. It was really rewarding, not just using my platform or the podcast as a platform to entertain and to provide travel inspiration, but really getting to use it to talk about things that are important to me and issues that are really important, not just in relation to travel and tourism, but personal issues, environmental issues, and things that just change your perspective on the world. And I really, really enjoyed diving deep, if you excuse the pun, into so many different aspects of that theme. And it just made me be even more certain that producing seasons with an overarching theme is my favourite way of producing the podcast. A huge shout out goes out, of course, to all of the members in our Patreon community. Their support really makes the show happen and makes it possible for me to set time aside and, to be quite honest, to have the headspace and the motivation to tell more stories and record more episodes. Of course, they don't just get to support my work, they also get a lot of cool benefits and perks in return, such as exclusive bonus content, glimpses behind the scenes, and we're just about to launch our very first social hangout as well. So it's about spending time with me, getting to ask stories, getting even more stories about my life and about Scotland, more videos, more pictures, all the things so that they have more Scotland in their lives. If you would like to join the Wild for Scotland Social Club, that's the name of our Patreon community, you can find the link to join in the show notes, or you can visit patreon.com/wildforscotland. Now, to celebrate our birthday, we are sharing one of my favourite stories back from season 3. It's called Flourish and tells the stories of some of the unsung heroes of Glasgow. Enjoy. I'm standing in a gloomy room,
with low ceilings. Whenever I take a step on the cold stone tiles, I can hear the echo travelling through the large room. But there are stone columns and arches all around me, obstructing my view. On the far edges of the room, there are tall, thin windows, but even though light is pouring in, it's fairly dark where I'm standing. In the centre of the room, there is an altar, covered in a colourful cloth, and a cross resting on top. Only that it isn't an altar. It's the tomb of St. Mungo, the patron saint of Glasgow, and founder of the city. I'm at the crypt of Glasgow Cathedral, a big medieval church in the heart of the city, and the oldest building in Glasgow. It has three parts, a large open nave with tall stone arches and colourful stained glass windows. Look up and you'll find that the ceiling looks like an upside down boat. The choir at the front of the church is separated from the nave by a stone carved pulpitum. It's filled with wooden benches and the ceiling carries the colourful crests of Glaswegian nobility. Below lies the crypt and the tomb of St. Mungo. A long time ago, in the 6th century, Mungo, who is also known as Kentigern, built a church here on the River Clyde, in exactly the same spot where Glasgow Cathedral stands today. As his community grew, so did the village around. When he died, Mungo was buried at this church, and it is believed that his remains still rest here today. Here is the bird that never flew. Here is the tree that never grew. Here is the bell that never rang. Here is the fish that never swam. This verse tells of the four religious miracles St. Mungo performed, but it also represents the city's coat of arms. His is a story that is inextricably connected to the story of Glasgow. You almost can't tell one without the other. He even coined the city's slogan, "Let Glasgow flourish." But of course, there are many more stories hidden beneath the surface and between the cracks of stones and buildings. Let's listen to some of them. I leave the crypt, climb the stairs back into the nave of the church, and exit through the tall doors at the back. There, I join a group gathering outside, and our journey begins. I'm on a women's heritage walk of the Glasgow necropolis, the city of the dead. I hear stories of notorious women and forgotten heroines who have been buried here during the 19th and 20th century. We'll hear about witches and gypsies, women who've dedicated their lives to the service of others, and women who left fortunes to let Glasgow flourish. Our tour guides are volunteers of the Glasgow Women's Library. They are the history detectives who have gleaned information and stories to build tours around the city that share these often forgotten or untold tales. Today, there are 6 women's heritage trails through different parts of Glasgow, 2 routes to explore the history of the city's suffragettes, and 1 LGBTQ heritage trail through the city centre. On these tours, the guides share insights into the lives of Glasgow's women and their role in society. They tell us about outstanding women who call the city their home. And most importantly, they tell gripping stories to bring these histories to life and give them relevance, no matter how much time has passed. After all, women have always made up 50% of the population. So why are they so blatantly absent from recorded history? Our walk on the necropolis begins just outside the cathedral. We make our way to a tall stone plinth that is decorated with carvings of thistles and flowers. But as beautiful as it may look, it's shrouded in a dark story.
In post-Reformation times, this is where women accused of witchcraft were imprisoned and often put to death. So a particularly vicious time for this was during the reign of James VI, which was 1566 to 1625. And he had a real hate campaign against women alleged to be witches. And here's a story about one of them. So Margaret Aitken was known as the Great Witch of Balwearie. And she claimed that she could identify witches by a mark in their eye. And so the church authorities loved this, and they took her round from town to town, and she'd be branding women as witches, and of course that condemned them to death, basically. Then back in Glasgow, somebody had a bright idea, and they decided to test Margaret. So what they did was they took her round some of the women that she'd already identified as witches, and this time she said some of them weren't witches. So there was an outcry and an inquiry into how reliable these methods of identifying witches actually were. And for a time, the persecutions subsided. And thanks to a very brave Glasgow woman called Marion Walker, she obtained and leaked documents about the case. And those ministers and magistrates who'd wrongly condemned women to death were named and shamed. And what about Margaret Aitken, the Witch of Balwearie, I hear you ask? She was tried, confessed, and put to death. So there's a campaign to get a formal pardon to all those who were wrongly accused of witchcraft. So far, the First Minister has already given an apology, and another strand of the campaign...
The campaign our guide Annabel is talking about calls for justice for the 4,000 people who were accused of witchcraft in Scotland, tortured and executed at a rate nearly five times as high as the European average. The vast majority of them were women. This year, the Scottish First Minister has issued an official apology to the people who were persecuted as witches, and hopefully a pardon and a national monument will follow soon.
So now we are going to go through the gates of the necropolis, and we're going to stop a little way down on the left for Mary to tell you something about another monument.
Okay. We're now walking down the cobbled road that leads to the necropolis and across a bridge. In Venice, the Bridge of Sighs connects the prison with the Doge's palace, and the view from there was the last view people would see before they were imprisoned. In Glasgow, the Bridge of Sighs connects the world of the living and the dead. At the far end, there is a large stone arch with five orange gates. The necropolis, our guides tell us, was initially supposed to be a system of tunnels and catacombs dug into the hill behind the cathedral. Back in those days, cemeteries weren't always the peaceful resting place people wanted for their loved ones. Grave robbing was a common practice, and anatomy schools paid a good price for newly deceased bodies. The gated catacombs were supposed to hold off these body snatchers and ensure the bodies of loved ones would be safe. Shortly before the necropolis opened, though, a new law was passed that permitted physicians and surgeons to obtain corpses that were unclaimed after death, and it allowed individuals to donate their bodies to this kind of research. The age of the body snatchers had passed, and the necropolis became the garden cemetery it is today. We follow the paved paths leading up and down the terraced hill. To the left, impossible to miss, stands the tall cathedral. From this angle, it looks even bigger than it does on the inside. To my right, I can see the headstones coated in colourful patches of moss. There are walls covered in dark green ivy growing out of control. At the top of the hill, the tall statue of John Knox looks down on us. He led the Scottish Reformation in the 16th century, and even though he wasn't buried anywhere near the necropolis, the city decided there should be a monument to him here on this hill. There are 3,500 visible graves here at the necropolis. Many are marked by elaborate headstones, bearing all sorts of symbols. Doorways represent the passing through to the other side. Cherubs indicate the day of judgment. A snake catching its own tail stands for immortality. Celtic crosses represent the unity of heaven and earth, and draped or undraped urns reveal whether the person who was buried here died young or old. Statues tower above the graves of the city's most formidable citizens. Mausoleums, many of which have been restored by the Friends of the Glasgow Necropolis, pay tribute to its leading families. Few of them are women. But overall, these monuments barely scratch the surface, as well over 50,000 people are actually buried on these slopes, many of whom rest in unmarked graves. The grave of Colinda Lee is an exception. Colinda was a traveller, and famously the daughter of a leading gypsy family from Norfolk. Together with her husband George and their 8 children, she toured all over Great Britain to wow the Victorian society with their unique way of life. Like a travelling circus, they showcased their colourful dresses, their quirky caravans, and their magical skills. Ladies could have their fortunes read, and the Lees could make a living. Wherever they went, people were excited to attend these gypsy balls, and soon Colinda and George were known as the King and Queen of the Gypsies. In Scotland, Colinda even met another queen. Well, actually, the queen, Queen Victoria, and legend has it that she read her palm on the coast near Dunbar. And what was good enough for the queen was good enough for well-off ladies all over the land.
Queen Victoria was there, and she went into the Royal Epping Forest Gypsy Ball. I don't know if she paid her entrance fee or not, but yeah. I'm presuming she crossed Colinda's hand with silver, because that is the tradition after all, and Colinda read her palm. And of course they used that as good publicity, and so it became fashionable for other middle class Victorian families to go in and see the ball and have their hands, their palm read by Colinda. Now, the balls were obviously a means of survival, calling themselves kings and queens. It was an attempt to gain kudos, because obviously that was an attack.
In Glasgow, Colinda and George set up shop in a market area near today's Barras, which is to this day a place for all things quirky and alternative. She died in 1900 and was buried right here at the necropolis. The inscription on her gravestone reads that she was charitable to the poor, loved and respected by all. Today, it is a common practice to leave a coin at her grave and wish for good fortune. I see hundreds of them in the cracks between plinth and headstone. Others are coated in deep orange rust. I take out a coin and find a free slot. Who knows what it's good for? One for good luck. We continue our walk to the top of the hill. Up here, you can see the most magnificent tombs, rivaled only by the views of the city. You may find that a cemetery is a weird place to visit, but once you're up here, you'll see why it's one of my favourite viewpoints of Glasgow. We stop by a wall and look out onto the sprawling city. Glasgow lies in a valley of the River Clyde. You can easily see the city limits to the north and south, framed by hills and mountains. In the north, you can see the round backs of the Campsies, the peak of Dungoyne, and on a clear day, if you're lucky, the top of Ben Lomond. To the south are the Braes, Cathkin and Glenifer, and at their tops you can see the first windmills rise into the sky. East to west is another story, though, as the city reaches along the valley, engulfing one suburb after the next, closing the gaps between them. Leslie, another one of our guides, points out some landmarks we can see from here. There are the tall trees over at Glasgow Green, Glasgow's first public park. Not far from there is where the first public wash houses were built in 1876. In Scotland, they're known as the Steamies. They formed an integral part of women's lives. Not only did they come here to bathe and wash clothes, the Steamies were also an important place for socialising, catching up with friends for women and their children alike. Some even had nurseries. Long before washing machines were available, women would queue for hours to get a spot at the Steamies, and to tell the story of Glasgow without mentioning the wash houses would be an incomplete history. Another building that stands out in the landscape is the Templeton Carpet Factory, or rather, the building that used to house the factory. Its distinctive facade was modelled after Venetian palazzos and decorated in a colourful mosaic. Today, it is home to numerous businesses, including a brewery. But back in those days, the people who worked here produced carpets that went to grand houses around the world. Even the Titanic had a carpet made at Templeton. But working there wasn't easy. Carpet making is a dusty business, and many women and men who worked here faced problems with their lungs in later life. And there is another sad story to tell about the factory. On the 1st of November, 1889, while the factory was still under construction, a wall collapsed and killed 29 women and girls who were trapped inside. In 2005, a memorial was created for them beneath the base of Templeton Gate. But not all of the stories told here at the necropolis today have such a tragic fate. Annabel leads us now between a row of towering headstones until we reach a large tomb. Three steps lead up to a gabled stone sarcophagus with carved decorations. This is the family tomb of John Elder, his wife Isabella, and her brother, John Francis Ure. John Elder was a successful shipbuilder and ran a shipyard in Govan, a district on the south side of Glasgow. It was regarded as one of the world's leading shipyards, and when he died in 1869, Isabella took over the business, first on her own and then with her brother. Isabella was a wealthy woman, and she used her fortune to improve the lives of the people of Govan, the workers from the shipyard and their families, and everyone else who lived here. She built a park across the road from the shipyard and dedicated it to her late husband. Next came a library and a hospital, a school for domestic economy, and a nurse's training home. She donated money to the University of Glasgow to support the Chair of Civil Engineering and the Chair of Naval Architecture. But it was the education of women that was particularly close to her heart. She gifted a building in Glasgow's leafy West End to Queen Margaret College, which offered higher education to women who were restricted from attending the university. Isabella's donation funded medicine courses for women, with the stipulation that they were to get the same level of education as their male colleagues. Later, the college was integrated into the university, and Dr. Marion Gilchrist became the first woman to graduate with a degree in medicine. It is a sign of fate that she would also be the doctor to sign Isabella Elder's death certificate. A year later, a statue was erected in Isabella's memory, becoming only one of four statues of women in the entire city of Glasgow. The others are of Queen Victoria, Spanish Civil War heroine Dolores Ibáñez, and Mary Barber, a workers' rights activist who led the Glasgow rent strikes in 1915. Without these and other women, the history of Glasgow would read like a book with half the pages missing. Flourished, the city would have not. The Glasgow necropolis is full of their stories, some tragic and sad, others uplifting, inspiring, or even entertaining. So come, if you dare, and follow my footsteps on a tour of the City of the Dead. I hope you enjoyed this story about the women of Glasgow and the necropolis, whether you listened to it before or heard it today for the very first time. The guided walks with the Women's Library are far and few between these days, but you can download all their women's heritage walks from their website and explore the history of Glasgow's women on your own.
Some of them even have audio tours to listen to on your phone. We'll be back with a new episode of Wild for Scotland very soon. In the meantime, why not revisit some of our other stories, like Island Hopping, which was our very first episode 3 years ago. If you join our Patreon community, the Wild for Scotland Social Club, you'll soon be taken on a little wintry trip to the Cairngorms National Park with me. Members of our Patreon community get exclusive content from behind the scenes, monthly bonus episodes, we have a private Facebook group to mingle, and I'm about to host our very first Zoom hangout, where you'll have the chance to ask me questions about the show, travelling in Scotland, or anything else really. You can find a link to join in the show notes or visit patreon.com/wildforscotland. And with this, I send you off to dream about your own trip to Scotland. If you enjoyed today's story, leave a 5-star review for us in Apple Podcasts, or take a screenshot of your podcast app right now and share what you liked about the story on social media. Wild for Scotland is part of the Tremula Network, adventure and outdoor podcasts off the beaten path. The show is written and hosted by me, Kathy Kamleitner. Thanks to Fran Dorowskis, who is our co-producer and editor and does the sound design. Michelle Payne and Anessa Motanda Mambingo are supporting the podcast and Tremula Network with social media. Podcast art is by Lizzie Vaughan Knight, and all original music is composed by Bruce Wallace. Until next time, when we travel to a different place in Scotland. If you're still here, listening all the way to the very end, it means you've probably got your hands full. So let me take this opportunity to remind you that I don't just write immersive travel stories. I also plan unforgettable itineraries for Scotland, and it's never been easier to follow one of my routes. Head to watchmesee.com/shop to browse my ready-made Scotland itineraries and turn your travel dreams into reality.